From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, an innovative weather meteorologist gives us an extended forecast as temperatures plummet.
Two films made by Milwaukee filmmakers premiere at Sundance this weekend. One is a virtual reality film about the pioneering tennis player Arthur Ashe.
Part of the goal with Ashe 68 was to take you to the day that he won the U.S. Open and kind of put you right there next to him as this important thing is happening.
Another is a day-in-the-life story that almost didn't get made.
2 years, I believe, into the process, we began to feel a little bit foolish because we still were not able to make the film because very few people who lived in Milwaukee is a place to make a great movie.
We'll learn about an exhibit at Latino Arts made possible by the Mexican consulate here, and Bubbler Talk illuminates a key invention from Milwaukee history. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The past week has brought a lot of inclement weather to the Milwaukee area. From snowstorms to the extreme cold, the ferocity of Wisconsin winter has been on full display.
Austin Scheib from UWM's Innovative Weather Center has been following the ups and downs of the current weather system moving through Milwaukee. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers with a forecast of what we can expect in the coming week.
We did have the cold front come through last night, which brought significantly colder temperatures to the region last night and into this morning. And winds will gradually decrease for tomorrow, but wind chills for the morning hours definitely approaching the negative 30 degrees mark, and they won't get much better throughout the day, where we'll still have wind chills well below zero, with highs only reaching right around one. And it's not going to be much better into the weekend as highs struggle to make it into the 1 degree mark. But we do have hope coming into Monday as temperatures do rebound back into the 20s, but a more significant cold shot arrives into next week as well.
Okay, so today, bitter cold. Over the weekend, bitter cold. How many truly bitter cold days are we expecting through January, which really ends next week?
Yeah, so at least Monday will probably be the more seasonal day of the rest of the week, but we will be talking much colder air arriving into the middle of next week as well.
Okay. So what is that going to mean for the snow that's already on the ground right now? Because there are certain areas of the city even that still have pretty significant pileups.
Yeah, so that will definitely be a concern going forward because we will have temperatures falling. So the snow, which was light and fluffy over the past couple of days, is going to freeze and become a much denser snowpack, which will make it a little bit more difficult to move if they haven't moved it already.
Okay, what is it going to mean for road conditions over the weekend and going into, you know, the weekday commute?
Yeah, there will definitely be some slick spots, and especially because we're dealing with blowing and drifting snow with this basically through the morning hours as winds gradually diminish. But with the colder temperatures, we will have to contend with some slippery spots on the roadways.
So are we expecting snow in the forecast?
Yeah, as it looks right now, we will have that chance for some accumulating snow returning on Monday and into Tuesday morning with colder air, again, on the backside of that system. But then it looks like we'll at least turn dry into the end of next week before we'll start talking about snow chances again.
So, you know, anytime we're talking about weather that is at or below zero, I think people immediately go to, you know, is it safe to be outside? What are the risks right now of being outside? How long should people spend outdoors?
Yeah, a general rule of thumb is, you know, 30 minutes outside or less is a pretty good rule of thumb, especially when we're talking wind chills approaching that negative 30 degree mark. If you have any exposed skin, you will be running that risk of frostbite and hypothermia if you're extending time outside with that. So if you're keeping, you know, outside under 30 minutes, up to 30 minutes, if you're really bundled up and prepared for the cold, that's kind of the concern that we start running into with this.
Yeah. And for those of us who may have to stay outside, make sure that you're really, really prepared.
Yeah, definitely hat and glove type weather coming up.
So this feels pretty typical for January. It is very cold, but how does it compare to last year and what we generally experience in this region this time of year?
Yeah, so this certainly isn't out of the normal. If we go back to New Year's of last year, we did have a similar type of cold approach where we had highs only reaching near negative 6 and we had low temperatures around negative 7 with wind chills. Pretty comparable to what we're going to see this weekend. And in terms of normal, we do see normal high temperatures right around 29 degrees with a low of 15. So we are below average, but this is not out of the norm for January.
So I know this is kind of a loaded question because you can't look too far into the future, but how far out can we predictably look at the weather, and what are we looking at?
Yeah, so realistically, we look 5 to 7 days out where we can get a pretty good picture of what's going to be happening. And then after that, we can get general ideas of what's going to happen, but it's not, there's subject to change in what the forecast does. And looking through the extended, we do have a pretty good cold shot arriving well into next week. And then outside of that, models suggest we could flip it back to a southwest flow, which would bring more seasonal temperatures into the end of next week. But at least through Thursday, we'll still be contending with much colder temperatures.
All right. Well, hopefully everybody stays bundled up. And Austin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Austin Scheib is a meteorologist with UWM's Innovative Weather. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can hear more coverage from Innovative Weather every day on WUWM News throughout the day.
Two films by Milwaukee filmmakers are premiering at Sundance this weekend. We'll hear about each of them coming up on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Now with more of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are two groups of Milwaukee filmmakers in Utah this weekend, premiering their films at the Sundance Film Festival. We'll hear about both films in the coming minutes. Filmmakers Brad Lichtenstein, Jeff Fitzsimmons, and Maddie Power are all part of the production company called Custom Reality Services.
Their latest project is a short documentary that combines sports, social justice, history, and virtual reality. The short film is called Ash 68 and is about a pivotal moment in the life of tennis great Arthur Ashe. The three filmmakers joined us before they left for Sundance. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Why is now the time, or really last year the time, to do a film about Arthur Ashe?
Sure. Well, one of the things that is so relevant today about Arthur Ashe's story is sports and activism, that we live in a day and age where we are still debating whether or not Colin Kaepernick taking a knee is something that the NFL should be able to control or not, and what that means in the context of the struggle against racism. And that struggle is surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, very similar to that struggle in 1968.
So if that is why now, why is VR the way to tell the story?
Well, it's a great way to tell the story because it gives you an environment that is much more immersive than a traditional media experience. So by having a 360-degree palette to work with, we can engage your senses and engage your physical movement in a way that is really exciting and makes you feel like you're there. And part of the goal with Ash 68 was to take you to the day that he won the U.S. Open and kind of put you right there next to him as this important thing is happening.
One of our goals, too, is to reach young people. And VR is a technology that is very readily accessible to young people. And a lot of young people don't know the story of Arthur Ashe at all.
Well, and in a lot of ways, this seems almost like a primer, an introduction to get people to spend more time with his story.
Yeah. I mean, when we premiered at the U.S. Open, we had a ton of young people come in who had never heard of Arthur Ashe but just knew that there was a stadium named after him. One boy thought he was an old, white, rich man who, after seeing the VR experience, were like, yeah, I'm going to go and read about Arthur Ashe, you know. Especially it's touching when it's, you know, young people of color.
Well, and so how did you arrive at sort of what corner of the story to tell?
Well, the moment that he wins the U.S. Open, it gives him a platform to then be able to advocate for social justice. And Arthur Ashe understood that. He actually said at one point that he had to keep winning. He had to stay in the game in order for his voice to be heard. So that's the moment that we focus on, is when he inherits that. Well, I shouldn't say inherits. When he deservingly wins that platform.
What did you take from the experience of screening it for the people who got to see it at the U.S. Open?
I'm sure we all have stories. One story I'll tell is when we were screening at the U.S. Open, there was a man who came in, I don't know, maybe in his late 60s. And afterwards, I noticed that he was visibly upset. Something had made him very emotional. And I was not revealing to people that I was one of the filmmakers, so because I was curious what the audience thought. So I came up to him and just said, I see that the film really affected you. Do you mind sharing with me? And he started to say something, and then he began to cry, and then he walked out. So I hesitated for a minute and then decided I would walk out after him and introduce myself as a filmmaker. And then we started talking. It turned out that he was and is the UCLA girls team, women's team tennis coach, and that he has been doing that for many, many decades. And it wasn't until this year that he had more than one black tennis player on his team, and that all these years that's been his goal is to really, you know, increase the inclusion of that sport, and that he always had Arthur Ashe's portrait up above his desk, and that he knew Arthur Ashe. Arthur Ashe was a mentor of his. And so for him, it brought all that kind of right up to the surface for him. And then he also said this very kind thing, which is that if Arthur were alive, he would have loved this, which pretty much slayed me right there. But that's the kind of experience that makes you feel like it was worth making the project.
You mentioned the advantages of telling it in this immersive format. At the same time, what were the challenges in being able to do that?
Lots of challenges. So one overall challenge, I think, is that VR and telling stories in VR, there's just not really a framework for that yet or a direct path. You know, VR filmmakers, we're all figuring this out as we go on. So
what does that mean? From a practical sense, when you're a filmmaker but you're doing it in this new way, what's the difference in being able to tell a story in VR versus, you know, I guess the traditional or linear or whatever
flat
the
film.
Flat film way
sure.
is.
Sure, flatty is what we call it. Well, I think one thing is utilizing this 360 space and how to make that interesting. And I think as a filmmaker in VR, especially if you come from traditional film, you're letting go of a lot of agency where you get to pick where the audience is looking. So in VR, obviously, somebody can look all over the place. So
yeah, when I watched it, you made sure to remind me to look all over the place as mm-hmm. as I was watching this film.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So with that, you know, it's a creative path. You're trying to figure out how to make that interesting. One specific example, I think, is the hallway scene where you're following Arthur, a young Arthur, down the hallway of the West Side Tennis Club. And depending on where you look, you see a different reaction to his presence in that club. So, you know, you can look to the right and you see an older couple kind of lean over and gawk at him. Or you can look to the left and there's two young girls kind of protecting themselves. Or behind you where, like, the security guard is just kind of closely watching him.
Right, staring dagger eyes into his back, basically.
Sure. Right. And from a practical standpoint, you know, with a traditional film, you set up the shot that you're intending to get, and then the rest of the crew hides behind the camera, and you work that way. But with this type of 360 filmmaking, a lot of times, especially that hallway scene, for example, you're seeing everything at the same time. And so you have to construct the scenario to accommodate the fact that the crew can't be anywhere around or is monitoring it remotely, which provides challenges for the director to make sure that you got the performance you're looking for and that kind of thing.
Right. So, from a practical standpoint, is there a physical camera person who is shooting this, and that's the only person who is invisible in the scene?
So she's actually – first of all, her name is Eve Cohen. She's amazing. She is actually setting up the scene, and then also she walks away in the scenes that we shot 360 at once. We also shot some of the scenes nodally, which means we pointed in one direction, got everything, and then turned around and got everything in the other direction.
And they're stitched together.
And they're stitched together. Exactly. So like the scene on the court when Arthur wins match point, that was shot in this kind of way. And so she and us, we were all on one side of the camera, but it still presents a lot of challenges, like making sure that those two shots are going to stitch together. And we shot that scene also to incorporate the sand animation. So
I was going to ask where the animation comes in this.
So the animation was done by two women, Masha and Rua, who live in Northern California, teach at CalArts, and are two of the only people on Earth who do sand animation, as it turns out. Something we really wanted to represent backstory and also to sort of represent the inner space of Arthur's mind. And they created, I believe, 4,700 plus frames to do that animation. They did it on a light table, which actually I will toss to Jeff to describe.
Sure. So this type of animation had been done before, and we were noticing early on in the project that we wanted something that was very tactile. And a lot of the animation that you're seeing in VR now has this kind of tilt brushy feel. It's all very similar. So we went to this technique.
Tilt brush, by the way, is a program that people use in VR to basically paint or write or create images.
Yeah, and so a lot of the animation styles look very similar, and we wanted something different. And Brad identified this this short piece of this type of animation that is sand. So they'll do a sand painting on a light table, take a photograph, move it a little bit, take another photograph. Very tedious, but it has a very granular and tactile feel to it. So we identified Masha and Rua, and the problem is that the people who had been shooting this were shooting on platforms that were like 18-inch squares, and that was still taking a tremendous amount of time. And when we started to calculate the resolution that we needed to go 360, we realized we needed something much, much bigger. So I flew out to their studio and built a light table that was 2 feet by 5 feet, and they were creating images that were 2 feet by 5 feet for each frame. So the amount of work that they put into this over the year that we were producing this was extraordinary.
It took them 8 months to do all the animation.
So you're about to have the official premiere of this at Sundance, and having being filmmakers and being at a traditional premiere when everybody's looking at the same thing in the same way on the same screen, what is it like to see an audience of people who are all experiencing the same thing in different ways and ways that you can't really necessarily tell until it's over?
Ask us when we get back.
I mean, are you going to have a room full of people with these headsets?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did, with our other piece, they did something similar at the Future of Storytelling in New York, where they had this was a rudimentary version of synchronized VR. And the other piece that we were showing was supposed to be a volumetric experience, which means that you can walk around in it. But we created a 360 version specifically for this screening. And so, yeah, they put headsets on 30 people on swivel chairs, and then they used a laptop to trigger them all at the same time. And it was kind of interesting seeing everybody sort of rotate their chair at the same time and spin all the way around. So it's kind of like watching people.
Unlike watching a tennis match.
Exactly. Only it's right. All around them.
A synchronized watching. Mm-hmm.
So I'm anticipating it's going to be something like that. But, the experience of showing these VR pieces to someone one at a time, like even at the U.S. Open, it was really great to be the one to actually put it on their heads and then be there when they take it off, because you're getting each person's individual reaction right at the time that they've just experienced it. So the feedback is extraordinary, and that kind of one-on-one interaction is pretty exciting.
Congratulations to all of you, and best of luck with us at Sundance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Fitzsimmons, Brad Lichtenstein, and Maddie Power are three of the filmmakers behind the virtual reality short film Ash 68, which premieres Saturday at the Sundance Film Festival. You'll find a link to more about it at WUWM.com.
The other Milwaukee-made film premiering at Sundance this weekend is Give Me Liberty. We'll learn more about it when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We last spoke with writer and producer Alice Austin and filmmaker Kirill Mihanovsky in 2014 when they were just beginning their Kickstarter campaign for the Milwaukee-inspired and made feature film Give Me Liberty.
The film is a day-in-the-life story that follows Vic, a young Russian-American who drives a handicapped transport van in the city and shares an apartment with his grandfather. Austin and Mihanovsky wanted their dark comedy to be raw, authentic, and reflective of Milwaukee, as well as a meditation on the American dream. And the film itself has become a realization of another dream. It's playing at the Sundance Film Festival throughout this weekend.
Austin and Mihanovsky joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio before they left for Sundance to talk about Give Me Liberty and how they hope it will be a catalyst for more filmmaking in Milwaukee. Mihanovsky starts by explaining why they refused to make the film in any other city.
Well, from the get-go, we wanted to make not just a movie, but also a world-class movie that could compete with the bigger films out there, because the competition is pretty fierce. There are thousands of films, especially today with the technology. And to make something that is truly outstanding and gets picked up for distribution, it's not easy. And especially in Milwaukee, because there's no industry, film industry. It's a wonderful city. It's a wonderful town. It's growing. It's expanding.
And that's shifting. I mean, that's beginning to shift with No Studios and the work Jonathan Jackson has done through Milwaukee Film, and they've been great supporters of what we're doing. But it still is like a hurdle. I think we were unwilling to lower our understanding of where the film could be. And you know, that required just a great deal of tenacity on both of our parts.
It's a part of our ethos, and it has very little to do with perfectionism per se. It's really not willing to do anything below our standards.
One of the things that the film reveals is this craft, like this understanding of, because a lot of people go out and they shoot movies, and it's really easy now. You know, it's digital. You can just go out and make a movie. And there is a certain craft that is lost, and it's a craft that's a little more alive in Europe. I think it was really gratifying in the last couple of weeks to see the film embraced so profoundly by some Europeans who really know cinema, and see that they recognized it as, you know, as cinema. It was really, really exciting.
We wrote this script rather fast, and it almost immediately got amazing response. With the first iteration was an 8-day plot involving probably close to 100 of characters. People loved it. The reaction was amazing. And it was inspired by Milwaukee, made for Milwaukee as the main character. There were a lot of attempts to take it anywhere else. We stuck to our guns. And 2 years, I believe, into the process, we began to feel a little bit foolish because we still were not able to make the film because very few people lived in Milwaukee as a place to make a great movie. And obviously not a lot of funding is available really in Milwaukee, aside from the wonderful Brico Foundation grant that we received from the Milwaukee Film
Well, and there were some people who along the way helped us and supported us.
Right, exactly. There's a number of people with great vision for the city through cinema, because we believe that cultural life can be boosted through the budding film industry in the city. It's obviously a long-term process. It can take a little time, but we always saw ourselves and the film as a catalyst.
We had this big, incredible script, and people were kind of having trouble hooking into it. And part of it was, what's Milwaukee? What is Milwaukee really?
Nobody has.
And all of a sudden, we made it into a 24-hour timeline, and it just landed. It clicked with everyone. So we had very, very well-known actors reaching out to be in the movie. It became very funny. You know, the process became very funny because we had started with this whole idea of authenticity. And we could easily have been swept up in this notion that we really had to cast a very well-known British actor as a young Russian-born 25-year-old immigrant with a Russian family. And I think that was a really close call for the project, because we were working with partners who really wanted a very circumscribed film. They wanted it to be sort of very square. There's a French word, it's carré, which is really a great word for what they were trying to do with it. And we were getting notes that we're not pushing it in the right direction creatively. And Kirill, as a director, is, you know, he takes the script and then he is on set, and there's a great deal of freedom that has to be there. And I understood that. And I understood that freedom is partly this energy and this capacity to live in the moment and really capture things on film. And that as his creative partner, that was something I really needed to support and we really had to do.
Do you think that Kickstarter, because so many projects, I mean, with the advent of tech that everyone is accessible to for films, Kickstarter is a very common way to make a project happen. Do you also think that Kickstarter is right now the best way to make a film more authentic?
No. I mean, for us, Kickstarter was a way of just getting going, and it was wonderful.
Getting the word out.
It helped a lot, and it gave us some seed money, and it was...
To run the operation.
Yeah.
To be able to travel and pitch the film, and we were incredibly thrifty with that amount and very responsible, and I believe actually most of it actually went into our small-budget film.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the reality is that film financing is difficult. Anywhere, independent film financing is difficult. I'm really hopeful because I think there's movement in Milwaukee that film will be seen as a viable enterprise here because, you know, as the city's trying to expand different kinds of businesses and attract different kinds of businesses. Because it is, you know, it is a money-making endeavor. A lot of people do make money in film. Independent films ultimately in the States have to be financed. And we ended up, you know, financing the film primarily outside of the city, outside of Milwaukee. We were actually, because we made this decision to make the movie, and we didn't have all of our financing in place, which is normally never how I would do something.
We basically looked at each other in October of 2017, and there was an option of not making the film, theoretically speaking, because that's where we were. We were left high and dry. And we understood one critical thing, that if we didn't make the film, we would be ashamed of ourselves for the rest of our lives. We would not be able to look in the eyes of those who had trusted us with their money, including Kickstarter. We would be clearly ashamed to look in the eyes of those who stalled, who basically put their lives on hold for us. So whenever it comes to the, are you happy with the fact that you made this film or it's recognized by Sundance, et cetera, first and foremost, we're joyful because we were able to deliver on the promise to make this film. And finally, you know, when people found out that we made it, that we came through with the movie, that it's recognized, I think a lot of people whose lives were not dependent on it were relieved. They were relieved not to be disappointed in us. And that is an amazing feeling.
Well, the other thing that happened is we brought this cast together, and it's completely improbable. Cast.
Right.
So we found these people, all of whom are profoundly charismatic, and the most remarkable thing is they bonded and had the relationships in real life that they have in the movie.
Well, have the that relationship built and to have so much weighed on, well, not simple act of completing the film, but having the decision we need to make this, and as you said, coming through on that promise for people. Outside of Sundance, outside of everything that's happened, but now that the screening at Sundance is coming up, are you nervous about what that effect is?
I'm only nervous about one thing because we got back from Paris and landed, and I had an urgent email from Sundance in my inbox that said, hey, we can't read your CRU drive. And I was, of course, like panicked immediately, and we, you know, scrambled, and they do have CRU drives they can read. But so the only thing is really that I'm nervous about at this point is when that mounts on the screen and it's all working, we're good.
Yeah. What do you anticipate audience reaction? And then also just, I mean, there's a lot of stories of things that screen at Sundance and then all of a sudden their production companies, the directors, everything highlighted. So are you expecting that? Are you prepared for that? Or what is your hope with this experience of getting this film screened for a wider audience after so much trouble to simply remain and stick to your guns and to just finish the project in the first place?
Making a movie is the hardest thing, you know, on earth, but actually getting it
to be seen,
you know, in its perfect iteration, to be screened. Actually, the hardest thing about making a movie is getting the tickets to its premiere by the people who made it.
By the people who made it, because
Alice just spent about a month and a half of her life just kind of just wasted making sure everybody got a ticket. But I don't know about Alice. I'm not nervous at all. I think it's what's really important is we would like it to be screened perfectly, just the sound and the picture for people to just, you know, relish, enjoy it. And ideally, connect with it, you know, connect with it on a human level. Because truly what was Alice was describing earlier, I have my own definition of what happened, really, that after you generate so much energy and after so many false starts and you end up being in this position when you have to run for your life and make the movie no matter what, and it becomes just larger than life. It becomes that nonstop to be or not to be, give me liberty or give me death kind of situation. And we ran with it and we tried to make that movie and we tried to create this reality, recreate it and capture it. And these two waves of the reality resisting and us fighting for it, they clashed and they really gave birth to this amazing energy that miraculously got captured on film. So there is two aspects to it. There's the production aspect of it and there's metaphysical aspect to it. And I think that people who are open to this, the metaphysical side of this experience, will feel it and will laugh and will cry. We made this film for people to see, not just for our relatives, mm-hmm. and not for intellectuals, not for classrooms. We want as many people, want it to be seen by as many people as possible over the world. We want world distribution for this film. We want it to come to Milwaukee through another door as a film distributed in Milwaukee by a reputable company, and we have a great chance of having that happen. So our hopes are that the film gets picked up at Sundance. And what happened with the film, the reason people in France, in Russia, in where else? I mean, in other places connect with it, it's a great sign. Why? Because they can relate to the local problems in Milwaukee. They can relate to the humanity that we captured. And
to the struggles.
To the struggles.
I agree with all that. I think the only thing I would add is that we did not set out to write anything political. We wrote this story, and the story is based on the city of Milwaukee, these characters in it, some experiences Kirill had when he first came here and actually drove Transit Express. But ultimately, the film is political insofar as it brings people together in a very divisive time. And it's about our common humanity.
Inadvertently.
Inadvertently and in a really magical, beautiful way and powerful way. And we've seen now people from all backgrounds, all cultures respond to that. And it's so it's very timely and I suppose arguably more timely now than it would have been when we first. Yeah, exactly. It's really it hit the zeitgeist and that's it, but I think it's something. I think another thing you talk about a lot is we really hope people will see it again and again, that it's the kind of thing that, you know, you watch and rewatch.
Which brings me to the topic of how it was made. It was made exactly in the spirit of how it is, because a few years ago, we didn't have money to rent space for auditions. We were driving through the website, and we were looking for spaces, and someone indicated the Wisconsin African-American Women's Center. We popped in, we walked in and introduced ourselves to Josephine Hill. And she was absolutely puzzled by us. You know, who are these people? What are they doing in this area, this part of town? And what do they want from me? We explained what we wanted, what we needed. And she allowed us for the next 3 years to use the Wisconsin African American Women's Center for casting.
As a base.
As also as a base during the production, as a holding base. Free, absolutely. She never asked for a penny from us. And every time I would call her, yes, my dear, of course. And she was like, okay, well, you go make that movie. Mm-hmm. And every time she would see us day in, day out for 3 years, she never asked for a penny. And it's one of the, she's
We've
a prominent
been
community
able to,
leader.
To give
we
a little
were
bit
able
back to
give
her.
We, and actually, there's something a little more coming. But this is exactly the spirit of what we care.
Well, Josephine is one of the great unsung heroes in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. She does tremendous real work on the West Side for kids, for adults, for single parents, for, you know, college-bound young people. I mean, she's a remarkable person. And the Wisconsin African American Women's Center
completely
is
a overlooked place.
Totally under the radar place. And, you know, people talk a lot about the segregation in Milwaukee. We all know the problems in Milwaukee. And, you know, part of this process for us was just ignoring that and not being part of that. And we had a tremendous group of people from the West Side supporting the film and working on it and who are in it on camera, who are behind the scenes. And that was another important piece for us. So,
yeah, well, I definitely look forward to seeing what happens at Sundance and then hopefully it coming back around here so that we here in Milwaukee can see this film
Great.
As well. Thank you
Absolutely.
So much for coming in and talking about Give Me Liberty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alice Austin is the writer and lead producer of the new film Give Me Liberty. Kirill Mihanovsky is the film's director, co-writer, and editor. The film opened at the Sundance Film Festival yesterday, and it'll continue to play at the festival throughout the weekend. You can find out more about it at WUWM.com.
From film to photographs, the Mexican consulate loaned Latino Arts a set of photos of artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, and the gallery built a whole new show around them. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie Norris.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We tend to think of embassies and consulates as places where diplomacy happens, and they are that, but they are also cultural ambassadors for the arts of their home countries. Late last year, the Mexican consulate here in Milwaukee loaned Latino Arts on the Near South Side a group of photographs of famous Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera.
Rather than simply creating an exhibit of the photos alone, managing artistic director Jacobo Lovo decided to ask local artists to respond to the photographs as well. He then combined the resulting artworks with the photos for an exhibit called Diego y Frida, A Smile Halfway Through the Journey. I met Lovo at the gallery and wondered why Frida Kahlo seems to be having a moment 65 years after her death.
Well, I think that has a positive and a negative to it, being that she's such a powerful artist, a female figure as well. So that's a positive. And then a lot of people seem to gravitate to her story and the artwork that she created, which is all great. But I think some of that cachet that's forming now in a general public tends to be because she's been more commercialized. So you see her on wallets, you see her on backpacks, you see her on t-shirts, which, you know, kind of lessens her legacy, I think. And that's why we decided to continue with this exhibit, this parallel exhibit, and then later on January 28th, we're going to be doing a lunch and learn, which is going to be getting a little bit deeper into who she really was as a feminist, as somebody that has a gender fluidity. And keep in mind that Frida lived in the 1930s. Which was, you know, amazing because she's such a powerful feminine figure and a powerful artist, period, that she really would be more fitted to be now in the 21st century. But yet she was living in the 1930s, you know, laying those seeds to make people more accepted even then.
For people who don't know what her artistic background is, was she considered, you said surrealism, and certainly her work is surrealist, but did she pull on folk traditions as well? Was she considered in the folk art tradition?
Right, you know, and some scholars that focus on Frida might even bring up the fact that she probably wouldn't consider herself a surrealist. Most of the work that she is known for are her self-portraits. And she really just painted a kind of like her inner space. She was very much, you know, a very bold introvert. She painted those self-portraits, like I mentioned, but they were really just kind of telling her own personal story of how she felt. So she was definitely somebody that wore her heart on her sleeve through
which
her artwork.
Which is not really surrealism.
Which is not. Yeah. But the imagery, when you see it, is very much surrealistic in nature. But I think she just kind of did her own thing. She had her own voice and she was not afraid to communicate it through her artwork.
When we look at her work in the context of all the other artwork that was happening in the world at that time, it was a very fertile time for visual artists.
Yeah.
Did she break new ground? You know, do we look at her from an art historical perspective and say, that's a Kahlo thing? You know, it didn't happen before her, the way, say, certain kinds of things didn't happen before Picasso or didn't happen before somebody else that kind of took something and went in a different direction with it that no one else had done.
Right. Well, if we're thinking about what Frida and her legacy has left, and the bold use of color, the strong reference to that inner space
and communicating how you feel through imagery, but then also rooting it in your cultural heritage. It's something very much her signature. And if we look at somebody who was her contemporary, like Remedios Varos, who was a Spaniard expatriate that lived and flourished as a surrealist, a fellow female surrealist in Mexico City at the same time, if you put their work side by side, they're gonna be completely different. And you're gonna see how, while they were both kind of very much introverted and talking about that inner beauty, the color palette and the imagery are gonna be completely different. But if you see a Frida Kahlo painting and you see another one, you start definitely recognizing who Frida Kahlo is as an artist, and you might be able to pick out many more after that.
Right, there's a signature that basically says you look at it and you go, oh yeah, it's like when you see Picasso, you kind of go, oh, I know.
Right. Everything.
Even if I don't know that painting, I just kind of
from the
know.
Color palette to the composition. Uh-huh. She came from a family where her father was a photographer. So indirectly or directly, we don't know exactly, but she learned a sense of composition that is very, very sophisticated and is very evident in her work.
She and Diego had a very tumultuous relationship.
To say the least,
yes. And obviously it certainly fed her art. Did it feed his?
I believe so. As terrible as they were as a couple, the mutual respect that they had for each other as artists never waned. It was always there. They were married twice in their life, and they were always kind of each other's rock when it came to artwork, and motivated each other. Frida was about 22, 26 years younger than Diego, and she sought him out. And once Diego saw one of her pieces, he completely fell in love with her, and as an artist too. It's something very interesting to study their relationship, because Diego was, was not the most straight arrow as of men. He was very much a womanizer, she for her time period was very much a trendsetter, where she was very bold and very much was gender fluid. They mirrored each other for good and bad.
She was also in a lot of pain, too, mm-hmm. particularly towards the end of her life, and that certainly influenced her art as well.
Definitely. One of the things that Frida always had to deal with was that she suffered a very horrific accident. She was riding on a bus that was crashed into a truck, and she was impaled in that accident, which left her in a lot of pain throughout the rest of her life. And she had also suffered from polio as a young girl. A lot of the work that she created reflects that physical and emotional pain. Unfortunately, because of the accidents and the injury that she suffered, she was not able to bear children in her life. And that was one of the biggest emotional pains that she had to reconcile with through her artwork.
We're standing here in front of a picture of them when they were quite young.
At 4 years old, and those are her parents. Okay. And on the other side, we have Diego at 4 years old, and those are Diego's parents. And in the middle, we have a photograph of their first wedding day.
It's amazing. You just look at them, and if you know anything about their story, you think, oh no, don't. But at the same time, would we have had the art that we would have had from both of them? Who knows?
Yeah. That's a very much an interesting question to look into, because when they met, Diego was already pretty well known as a muralist. And then Frida was much younger, like I said, and then she came and sought him out to show him one of her paintings. And then that relationship kind of grew from there.
Grew from there for the rest of their lives,
yeah,
pretty much. Yeah.
Exactly.
Are there any other photographs or artwork you'd like to point out?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So in the gallery, we have this amazing, very large-scale portrait of Frida Kahlo, created by a local artist named Juan Flores. And it's a large canvas, over 12 feet tall by 4 feet. And it's just a striking portrait of Frida, but she's also holding a calla lily. And it's a tribute to Diego. So it's a very subtle way to include both artists, Diego and Frida. Diego is really well known for one of his series called The Flower Sellers, where he shows Mexican peasants that are carrying bundles of calla lilies to market to sell. And both Diego and Frida were one of the most powerful moments, or one of the most powerful points that they left in their legacy, was how they both decided to focus on enriching and bringing value to the labor that the indigenous people of Mexico provided. At that point in history, they were looked down upon and treated very much as a lower class. And Diego and Frida were very proud of their indigenous culture and heritage, and they brought it to light in a very positive and beautiful way through their artwork.
Has that translated to modern day? I mean, do artists in Mexico now, or artists around the world, not just in Mexico, look to them and have pulled some of those things forward into their work now? Do we see that in contemporary art?
I think it depends which realm of contemporary art you're looking at. With Diego's murals, which were very politically charged, he definitely left that legacy behind for other artists to follow. And it's a powerful one. If we look at the murals that he had created here in the United States for the Rockefellers in New York that were eventually destroyed, and then the ones that still exist now in Detroit City, they are very much about labor movements. They're very much about the working class and empowering them to show the value that they bring to society. So I think that those ideas that the working class should be empowered and validated for their hard work is something that still resonates to this day.
So what do you hope that people get when they come in here and maybe certainly see the photographs for the first time? And this is all new artwork.
Our goal is to continue to educate people about the cultural arts. They come from all over Latin America, and we hope for them to get to know Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo a little bit more in depth. Not the unibrow, or that when they see a T-shirt that has either Diego or Frida on them, they will know a little bit more of the rich history that they've left in the art world. And then also, we want the viewers to know that this exhibit gave us an opportunity to invite a variety of artists from throughout the community. Latino arts normally focuses on featuring Latino artists, but through this exhibit, we decided to invite other artists from all over the community because it mirrors perfectly the legacy they left. Diego and Frida are artists that are talked about in classrooms to all people, different backgrounds, and different heritages. So we have invited many different artists to come and exhibit this time around.
Jacobo, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Jacobo Lobo is the Managing Artistic Director at Latino Arts. Diego E. Frida, A Smile Halfway Through the Journey, is on exhibit through February at the Latino Arts Gallery. There is more information at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break and then return with Bubbler Talk. You are listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Mitch Tyke. Our Bubbler Talk question this week is one after my own heart. It came to us quite a while ago from Tim Brever in Oak Creek, who asked, "Dear Bubbler Talk, can you provide more context behind the typewriter being invented in Milwaukee?" In fairness, we should note that Tim sent us the question electronically. Our typing sounds are courtesy of the Olivetti Studio 44 that resides in my office. That was the portable typewriter favored by Tennessee Williams, but I digress. Dear Tim, as you might already know, there is a historical marker at the corner of 4th and State that denotes a nearby spot as the birthplace of the typewriter. Today, there aren't very many typewriters at that spot since it's now the wreckage of the Bradley Center. But just a half mile away, you'll find 947 of them.
My name is Al Mushka. I'm the curator of American history at the Milwaukee Public Museum.
Al knows a lot about the typewriters in the museum's collection, but there are two in particular he brought out to help us understand Milwaukee's key role in typewriter history. One of them looks more like a piano keyboard than what I'm typing this script on. It was the invention of Christopher Latham Scholes, a newspaper publisher who'd been living in what is now Kenosha. It was the mid-19th century, but Scholes got some of his fellow tinkerers together at a machine shop on State Street in a very 21st century way.
They got together and it was kind of like, these days, think of it as a business or invention incubator. You see them all over town, these little places where people get together and they start a business and they really kind of get going with it, and it's idea after idea after idea.
But Mushka says Scholes was an idea man, a dreamer. To scale up production of his new invention, he really needed what a lot of inventors need.
He needed somebody with business acumen, and he needed some more money. After many, many inquiries were sent by Scholes and his compatriots around the country looking for investors, Densmore answered. And Densmore put up every penny he had.
That's Pennsylvanian James Densmore, a former newspaper associate of Scholes, and every penny amounted to about $700. But with the money Scholes wanted came something he was less excited about, advice.
And he invested, gave Scholes the money, but then immediately started making suggestions to make it better. And Scholes responded well the first few times. After that, he started getting a little upset with the suggestions.
But a couple of those suggestions turned out to be pretty useful, like, say, the arrangement of the keyboard. After some prompting, Scholes developed a pretty familiar arrangement of keys, what we now know as the QWERTY keyboard. But where did that come from?
It looks like he began with an alphabetical keyboard, and you can still see that in the sequence D, F, G, H, J, K, L.
That's Richard Polt, a philosophy professor at Xavier University and author of the book The Typewriter Revolution. He owns about 300 typewriters, by the way, including an original Scholes and Glidden. But back to QWERTY.
Some of the type bars that were swinging up to make the impression were clashing with each other. So he apparently tried to separate commonly used pairs of type bars, for instance, TH, so that they wouldn't be too close to each other and wouldn't get stuck.
The other development Densmore pushes is to sell him more stake in the company so he can pursue new financing, which he does in what you might call rapid-fire fashion, signing on the Remington Arms Factory.
They had experience building guns, of course, but then after the Civil War, they needed new products. They'd been making things like sewing machines, and so they decided to take a chance and build this thing called the typewriter.
In fact, the other typewriter Al Mushka has taken out for us was one of the ones Remington made. Sadly, of the 947 typewriters in the Public Museum's collection, only one is the focus of a display there. But in closing then, Tim, Scholes and Milwaukee's contribution to the typewriter led to the next generations of typewriters, which led to the computer keyboard, which made it possible for you to ask your question. Sincerely yours, Mitch Tyke for Bubbler Talk.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Milwaukee, serving more than 41,000 children and teens each year. Dedicated to providing safe spaces, academic enrichment programs, and fun environments. More at bgcmilwaukee.org. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
And Bubbler Talk wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show, along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski, assistant producer Maddie Andre, and digital producer Lauren Sigfusson, plus the newest member of the Lake Effect team, intern Zoe Munson.
We get additional reporting from the WUWM news team, including Susan Bentz this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on Listener's supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.